Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls. I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and Stephen Bush from The New Statesman. So today, Jeremy Corbyn has unveiled his vision for the media, should he take number 10. And among his promises is the idea that he will tax tech firms to subsidise the BBC licence fee, and it also crack down on BBC staff by unveiling their social backgrounds. Stephen, what do you make of the plan so far?
Well, so the odd thing about the making the BBC reveal the social backgrounds of their staff is the BBC does already do this in its annual report. I mean, literally, they don't make a big song and dance out of it, but that bit's not that new. The bit about the... Now, obviously, the existential problem facing the BBC and public service broadcasting is increasingly small numbers of people, particularly young people, pay the licence fee, use BBC services. So if you want public service broadcasting to survive in some form, there is going to have to be an alternative funding mechanism. I'm not quite convinced on the idea that tech firms is the way to do it, not least because all of the indications are that both Netflix and Amazon are actually loss-leading businesses who've somehow managed to convince their investments and there will be a payday someday. So I'm not convinced about the payment mechanism. And of course, it is kind of leading with their glass jaw because obviously the leader's circle is quite posh.
Fraser, you're an editor. Do you feel like Jeremy Corbyn has a good grip on what the British press needs?
I think he's got quite a good grip of the political opportunities. Nobody likes the tech companies. Newspapers hate them. Newspapers think that they're taking away their advertising revenue. So right now, there's almost nobody who's backing these guys. So politically, you can say, look at these tech giants. Let's thwack them. Let's put the money towards helping journalists. Also note this reset of the language. It wasn't so long ago where Corbyn was coming out with videos telling journalists that change is coming and newspapers, you're going to get your comeuppance. Now he's saying, look, newspapers are being threatened by the new media, so we're going to protect journalists and newspapers by all of these various changes. So he's gone from being the avenger to the kind of liberator, liberating the BBC from political control by overhauling the way that it's run and various things like that. So you can see why, I mean, look, obviously I think it's a terrible idea, but I think nationalising the utilities is a terrible idea, the railways is a terrible idea. All of these things have big public support. I don't think the public are going to care a little bit too much. But to me, it really is. I mean, for example, he's got an idea of having large newspapers have the editor elected by the staff. Now, of course, I think this is a terrible idea, but even if I didn't, since when does the government allow or dictate to newspapers how they should choose their manager? You do get countries who do that kind of thing, but they're not countries who've got a free press.
But I guess, Stephen, Jeremy Corbyn does have a record in probably speaking on lots of state-sponsored TV channels, so maybe that's more what he's used to.
Well, yes, I guess there is the kind of ongoing sore that is the Labour leader's appearances on Russia Today and Press TV. I do think the interesting thing here is we know that we have a big problem with the collapse of local journalism, but it is really difficult to work out a desirable solution to that problem. Obviously, government subsidy has all sorts of problems because why would you investigate the organisation that funds you? But it feels clear that the way that the global economy is changing is never again going to create a situation where, you know, the Derby Telegraph can afford to investigate corruption locally in any level. So the odd thing is I think there is more merit in the problems identified in the speech than a lot of Corbyn's speech. I think actually there is a lot more in this speech than, say, the idea that nationalising the railways is going to effectively fix anyone's problems.
And that's why I think it's worth taking this seriously. I mean, it's actually a very coherent speech. About a lot of what Jeremy Corbyn says is perfectly coherent. He starts off saying the purpose of 21st century socialism is to have radical change, and he then outlines radical change. You cannot accuse him of inconsistency, except on one area. I think a lot of the problem the local papers face is that they face competition from the BBC with the various local... You've got a government, a tax-funded, effectively, operator, which is difficult difficult for people to compete with. And that is a factor. And yet, he would do more of this. He would have this other BDC, he'd call it the British Digital Broadcasting Corporation or something like that, which would, as far as I can work out, further compete with local papers. And local papers are, of course, burdened with debt. I mean, he says he'd give some of them charitable status, but they're not making profits to tax. But overall, I mean, I wish I could say this is all from the sort of deranged mind of Jeremy Corbyn, but it's consistent with what David Cameron was saying. It was Cameron who, first of all, had a state-mandated regulator he wanted the press to get behind. Corbyn is just taking this a few steps further.
Now, moving away from the press and onto purely Labour, Stephen, this week you've written about the potential for a split within the Labour Party and the idea that the moderates would move away. Why do you think the time is coming?
I think it's a combination of things. The first is, you know, the group that is certain to leave is the group that, well, basically when you say, well, what would this grouping look like? What would you do? What votes would you get? Goes, look, those are all second order questions. The first order question is, do we think he should be prime minister? And if we don't, we need to say that we don't, and we should try and do whatever we can to set out an alternative, even if that alternative is doomed to failure. And of course, the thing that has really crystallised that in a lot of people's minds is Labour's anti-Semitism problem. A couple of minutes before we went on air, this Daily Mail story about him referring to British Zionists. British Zionists is a category which includes the majority of Jewish people in this country. And that is much more important than anything else as far as the cause of a split. Labour MPs can swallow bits of economic policies they don't like. On foreign policy, most Labour MPs don't care about foreign policy. Their foreign policy is essentially to go, oh, it's too difficult, let's not get involved. But on this, for a minority of Labour MPs, it is something they cannot stomach, and they know they can't change it within the party. And that's why I think, you know, once Brexit is resolved, because for many Labour MPs in that position, their main priority at the moment is to soften or stop Brexit if they can, we will see a group breaking off, renouncing the Labour whip, and then trying to work out from there what they do next.
Fraser, if there is a break-off Labour group, do you think that is bad for Labour, as in Corbyn's Labour, or do you think that also poses a risk to the Tories if we start to see a new moderate central party?
Well, there's no doubt that a split in the Labour vote will benefit the Conservatives, just as the SDP split benefited them in the early 80s. And I don't think anyone in the Labour Party is in any doubt about that. The logic for doing the split is that it will rejuvenate a party that might otherwise be lost completely. I have trouble working out when, I mean, I've spoken, I mean, look, my sources are nowhere near as good as Stephen's. Anybody who wants to know what's happening with the Labour Party should read his New Statesman cover piece this week. But now and again, you know, you hear people saying, yeah, we're going to split off and we're going to be independent and then we're going to eventually set a new party. But people have been saying this for a while, as even, I don't know, you know, when we see, you know, let's John Woodcock, he split off and then just left the party completely. And you do wonder, what are they waiting for? What is the catalyst? Because there have been so many provocations. You mentioned, you know, today's revelations of anti-Semitism, but there have been so many things that have been just as bad. The second leadership election demonstrated that they were never going to get rid of him via the membership. So I think all the facts they've got now, they've had for quite some time, and yet nobody's done anything. And I can't quite work out what they're waiting for or what might change.
I think the big change is that at the moment, so the kind of when Labour MPs who are unhappy about Corbyn gather together, one of them will say, stay and fight. The others will go, what's your plan for successfully winning it back? He's on course for an NEC landslide. You know, the election has strengthened his control over the Labour Party. Then someone else will say, look, I agree with all of that, but we've got this opportunity to turn Labour policy on Brexit, so that needs to come first. When the Article 50 process has resolved itself, whether it resolves itself in a deal or a chaotic exit, that final bit of glue will have gone. And there will, of course, then be, in terms of them finding a reason to finesse that exit, there will, of course, be some kind of crisis, whether it's party rules changes, whether it's anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, that will allow them to go, right, I'm leaving. There will, of course, be the slight ridiculousness, and as you say, although today's Mail story, I think, will shock a lot of people, it's really more of the same.
And how would they reconcile themselves to helping the Conservatives in the next election, because certainly that's quite a strong argument. Also, the Blairites, not that they're Blairites, but the Labour centrists are the ones who the people they look up to tended to be the Blair, John Reid, the kind of people who didn't leave Labour in 83, the kind of guys who stayed and fought. So they think the moral of a new Labour story is one stays and fights and wins. And I'm wondering how they would be able to reconcile to themselves if they go in the next 3 or 4 years. The result certainly will be another Conservative government. Maybe they think that's better, however, than a Corbyn government.
Well, I think, so there are a couple of push factors. The first is that a lot of the people from that time in the 80s who are still around, particularly those in the House of Lords, are saying to various MPs, well, look, we stayed and fought, but there was always a right-wing majority among the trade unions, which is very much not the case now. And so we always had a way back, is what they are saying. And then they go, that doesn't apply now, so it needs a different response. But also, they don't think that it is inevitable that a Labour split will usher in Conservative hegemony. In terms of the SDP, Ivor Crewe and Anthony King's study of the SDP basically found that it took votes semi-equally from the two parties. Mm-hmm. They hope that they can do what Macron did and effectively cannibalise enough votes from both parties to break through via first past the post. So they hope they can do something better. And for some of them, you know, the irony is, there was one quote I kind of couldn't work out how to get it into the final piece, but they said, well, the way I see it is, if we have a decisive outcome one way or the other, I've stopped someone who I don't think should be Prime Minister being Prime Minister, whichever one of the two I've stopped it is. And they kind of feel that because they're so despairing about both options, they ought to at least try, even if it ends in failure.
Now, one of the dividing factors within the Labour Party, and part of the reason some moderates aren't sure what they're going to do, is, of course, Brexit. Today we've heard from Keir Starmer that he might be up for a people's vote, or at least the option of a vote on the final deal. Stephen, it's a question you've asked many times on this podcast before, but what exactly is Labour's Brexit position right now?
Labour's Brexit position is it would like to win as many votes as possible in a coming election, whether they be from Remainers or Leavers. And then it wants to be able to calibrate its position exactly to maximise the amount of votes it can get across the Remain-Leave divide. Barry Gardiner kind of went slightly too far on one side by saying, you know, they'll be fighting in the streets if we have a second vote. Keir Starmer kind of pulled it back to their kind of, maybe we will have a people's vote, maybe we won't. We're not currently calling for one. Now, there are two reasons why that is their line. The first is that they want to be able to keep sort of saying to Leavers, look, we hear you, we've accepted it, our leader's well Brexity, you can trust us, while winking at their Remain voters and going, but, you know, things could change. The other is that, although it is unlikely there will be an election this side of the Brexit process, the Labour leadership knows full well that the only way you can unify the whole Labour Party on Brexit is to agree to disagree by saying, you know, something like, you know, the Conservatives have wasted all of this time, the only people who can fix this this mess are you, the British people, and so we will have some kind of, I doubt they'll ever call it a people's vote, but they'll need some form of words which allows every Labour MP, from Clive Lewis to Kate Hoey, to be able to go into that election going, here's a form of words I can point to, which of course is the role of their six tests in the first place. And that's what you've got to understand about all of their twists and turns over Brexit. It is all about finding a position which allows them to have something to say in an election, which allows them to pivot back to their economic populist message, which is the stuff they think that they can really win votes on.
And if you want to read more about the people's vote, then do check out my column in this week's Spectator magazine. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Fraser.